Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Hello, and thanks for listening to Behind the Knife. This is Patrick Georgioff. We very much appreciate you tuning in, and we have put the pedal to the metal recently. We're doing our absolute best to crank out exciting and innovative surgical education content. If you haven't already, I encourage you to check out our trauma surgery video atlas. This contains 24 scenarios that, for the most part, don't exist anywhere in the world in video format. And the atlas also has beautifully done original illustrations and practical, easy-to-read pearls that help you dominate the most difficult trauma scenarios. We also recently released a CT surgery oral board audio review, which is excellent, and an updated vascular surgery oral board audio review and the book as well. And if you haven't already, you should check out some of our new videos. We've got amazing surgical skill content in our how-to video playlist. And we have two new partnerships to announce as well. The first is with our friends in Derby, England, who are putting together a really phenomenal series on minimally invasive management of severe pancreatitis. And the other is with a very good friend of mine, Vahag Nikolian, aka the Hernia Geek. His hernia videos are absolutely the best in the game. I reference them all the time. I share them with my trainees. They're really fantastic, so we're happy to have that partnership. Remember, you can find all of these things on behindtheknife.org and on our new app, which is available on Apple and Android devices. So now on to today's show. The other day, I was doing a lap chole with the amazing Dr. Austin Eckhoff, who's a resident at Duke. And during induction of the patient, it was mentioned that the patient is breastfeeding her little one. And in a very kind of knee-jerk response, I blathered something out about pump and dump. But fortunately, Austin was there to set me straight, and she provided some much-needed education. And with that, an episode was born. So we have some fantastic guests today. As I mentioned, Dr. Austin Eckhoff, she's a fourth-year general surgery resident at Duke who is currently applying to surgical oncology. We also have Dr. Annie Dotson, who is a family medicine and breastfeeding medicine physician here at Duke University. And Dr. Katrina Mitchell, who is a breast surgeon at Ridley Tree Cancer Center in Santa Barbara, California. She's also the creator of the Physician Guide to Breastfeeding, an evidence-based resource for breastfeeding families, breast cancer patients, and a surgery resource for lactation. So thank you all for being here today. So Austin, once you kick it off, we have a very simple case to begin this discussion.
Absolutely. And this was our actual case for that day. So it was a 39-year-old female who was lactating, and she was undergoing a non-elective lap chole for acute cholecystitis. One of the first questions I think about when I see her in the ED is, what imaging can I do? Can I use IV contrast with the CT scan? What about a HIDAS scan?
That's a great question, a very common question in the ER and surgical and medical floors. So less than 1% of iodinated contrast that's used in a CT scan is excreted in breast milk. So there's absolutely no need to discard that breast milk or interrupt breastfeeding. The same also goes for an MRI with gadolinium contrast. A HIDAS scan is a little trickier because a new U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Agency recommended breastfeeding interruption for 24 hours with any technetium-99 substance, but this is likely just an overcall to keep the regulations simple. Most likely, it's 12 hours for a HIDAS scan. However, the best case scenario would be that the person just got an ultrasound and you were able to make an operative decision based on that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I've actually always wondered these things, so the clarity is perfect. Now, we have this patient in the operating room at this point, and we have a number of different medications that we typically administer, including for induction and keep the patient asleep. Out of these common meds, Katrina, what do we have to think about? And when it comes to pump and dump, are we obligated to do so?
That's also a great question and an easy answer. So you don't need to pump and dump after any anesthesia. I would say the one thing I'd probably try to stay away from would be a paravertebral block that would impact the thoracic region, just because it'd be sort of strange to have a numb breast when breastfeeding. But otherwise, once the mother is awake, she has the drugs metabolized out of her system and is safe to breastfeed.
Yeah, this is mind-blowing to me. Let's talk opioids, for example. Are there a difference between the opioids that we have to think about or preferential use?
That is true. You do want to preferentially use morphine and hydromorphone or Dilaudid with IV medication because there's poor oral bioavailability, and you preferentially want to use Norco, i.e. hydrocodone, for oral pain control, but you don't need to pump and dump if you're using, say, something like oxycodone or Percocet. However, those are the more preferred ones. I think the biggest thing to remember is not to use tramadol or codeine, because some moms can be ultra rapid metabolizers of them, and this can result in high blood levels in the baby.
So is there a big enough difference between hydrocodone and oxycodone for a patient that are recovering, let's say, from abdominal surgery, and you need some narcotic pain control? Is hydrocodone that much better that we should be switching over to it as opposed to oxycodone, or is there not that much of a difference?
It's not a huge difference to the point that I would say someone had to pump and dump because they had oxycodone. It just has to do with the metabolism of the drug, and hydrocodone is just preferred. But again, I think Annie had brought this up too, that it's really every situation is a little bit unique with things like that. Is it a mom of a 25-weeker in the NICU, or is it a mom of a 10-month-old? But again, I think the real message, because the pendulum tends to sway way far on the side of pumping and dumping, is to just remember that the vast majority of situations, you don't have to. I tell my patients, basically, if you want an easy answer, you can't breastfeed with chemotherapy, but pretty much everything else, with some rare exceptions like thyroid radiation. But that kind of counts as, you know, cancer care in my mind.
And Annie, what about medications like propofol, very frequently used in the OR?
Yeah, all of those are really safe. You know, once the patient is awake enough after surgery, it's totally fine to start either pumping or feeding directly on the breast, which sometimes we forget about post-surgery in a PACU situation if an infant can be there. Also okay to direct breastfeed. You know, what Katrina was mentioning about the exceptions sometimes happen when we have infants that are kind of at high risk for some hypotonia, hypotension, or apnea, really young babies. So if that's the case, including your pediatric colleagues, your NICU colleagues into the conversation to see if there's a risk that isn't really for the breastfeeding in a normal situation, but in an exceptional situation would be reasonable.
Is there a specific age cutoff you think of?
I think that's so challenging because many of those babies are on a combination of different feeding things at that point. So they're often not on solely maternal breast milk from their parent. They might also be getting some fortification. And so there's no real cutoff. I would just include the NICU if you have somebody that has a really young baby.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, I think it just underscores where we all are with surgery as well in turning to non-narcotic pain control. And if you have a huge abdominal surgery, and that's a situation to use a block, you know, epidural, and to minimize narcotics there.
And there's a great paper from Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine that kind of talks about intraoperative medications. You can come look at, there's tons of resources to reference and know which ones are safe, and really most of them are.
At Duke, I know we have pumps that we can bring both in pre-op and post-op. Are there best practices, such as ordering pumps bedside or things like that, that we can help our patients?
Yeah, I think best practices, having access to a pump, really important. That can also include patients bringing their own personal pumps if they opt to do that. But certainly having access to a hospital-grade pump, both preceding a surgery and afterwards directly in the PACU is really important. I think having a policy in this case is critical, because there's many things that go into having that pump at the bedside, including having access to pump parts, having a protocol in place to teach the patient how to use a pump. Not all patients have used them when they come in for surgery, having some kind of assistance related to lactation if they need it, so that if a patient isn't able to do the pumping themselves, somebody can assist them, or to keep them on a timing that matches their feeding schedule if they aren't able to match that themselves. So all of those really are critical to lay out in a policy. And it's not just about having the pump, but having the resources available to really support the use of that pump.
I would add that having a mom breastfeed a baby, if she's able, is really the most ideal situation because it's going to stabilize her vital signs postoperatively. It's going to reduce her need for pain medication. And I think it can be relaxing for moms to be able to breastfeed their baby before they go back to the OR. And I have been very, very lucky to work with a lot of anesthesiologists who have really set the tone for our entire OR. It's not a surprise that there's a mom breastfeeding a baby before a case.
How did y'all get anesthesia on board to be partners in this?
I've been lucky that I've had a lot of younger female anesthesiologists who have been interested in promoting this education themselves, both at the hospital and the surgery centers. And again, I think I'm probably just lucky that there's a certain amount of culture of open-mindedness on this topic that I am aware doesn't exist everywhere. And I think it's just going to be a work in progress for a lot of places, particularly bigger institutions where there's a lot more red tape to jump through.
And Annie, you have experience with that in terms of big institutions and building something. If someone's interested in trying to get something together with their peri-op partners to engage with this material and ensure that patients benefit from it, do you have any recommendations for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think bringing people together at the same table is really important. You can kind of frame it around a committee or a work group is great. So that kind of sets it with a purpose. I think there are a lot of people that do care about this topic, parents in particular. Surgeons are also parents and maybe aren't vocalizing that as a priority. But once you really bring it to the table, it starts to become important because it's something many people have gone through themselves.
All right. So Katrina, we did surgery. We did our lap chole. It went well. How do commonly administered medications that we give after surgery affect lactation? This could be, again, opioids, NSAIDs, Tylenol, antiemetics, and even antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. So the opioids are, per what we had mentioned above, NSAIDs, Tylenol, antiemetics, all safe. Antibiotics are all safe with the exception of you want to be careful with some very young babies and Bactrim. That definitely is not the majority of patients, and there's usually alternatives to that medication as well. So even the things that people think of as big guns, you know, Vanco, well, it's probably not even a big gun in general surgery anymore. It's been too long since I've done general surgery, but, you know, the Zosyns, Vancos, they're all fine.
Are there meds they want to avoid because they decrease supply?
The only thing that's really going to impact production considerably is going to be something like Sudafed. But really, even antihistamines that traditionally have been thought of, like Benadryl or Loratadine, they're fine.
And scopolamine patches are also fine.
I would say scopolamine is probably not the most ideal as an antiemetic in a lactating patient just because of the other side effects of dry mouth and just the anticholinergic effects. But I'd start with probably Zofran and also just minimize narcotic usage to try to get ahead of the nausea.
And I think having a resource for what you should look at in terms of when you have a medication you're not sure about, eLactancia is a really great resource. It has information in English, Spanish. And it also includes case reports, which is really nice because some of the medicines that we might be administering might not have a lot of published data, might be based on one case report. So having that compiled can be great. There's some other ones like Infant Risk that has a call line, LactMed. Those are great too. Those are US-based, but just have a resource where you can look up your medicines.
Annie, is there a lot of literature for this? Because sometimes when I look it up, essentially every med has these very vague answers about safety for use with lactation or in pregnancy.
Yeah, I mean, some of it's based on pharmacology principles, based on the size of the molecule for the drug, because it is challenging to do real research in, you know, pregnant and lactating patients. But there can be some case reports that are published, which is why the eLactancia one is really nice.
Yeah, I would add to that that if you have a lactating patient, you want to use a lactation-specific resource like eLactancia. I tend to use LactMed, which is a NIH online resource. And as Annie had mentioned, they will not have a discrete yes or no or grading or number that can be scary or hard to interpret, but they actually discuss the drug, provide any case reports that exist. And even if there is nothing that is in existence, they will talk about the pharmacokinetics of the medication. For example, monoclonal antibodies tend to be very large molecules and would not cross the blood-milk barrier. And so they can extrapolate and say there's no information in this, but based on other drugs with the same properties, we can conclude this is likely safe.
Yeah, we're going to put links to those resources that you mentioned in the show notes so people can access those. And I think now would also be a good time, Katrina, you have a website too with a lot of fantastic information on it, right?
Yeah, so I put this together during COVID because I was just so frustrated with how isolated everyone was and how much misinformation was circulating on social media and online. And I called it the Physician Guide to Breastfeeding. And I really wanted to include everything I do with my breastfeeding medicine practice and the surgical aspects of my breastfeeding medicine practice, as well as surgery, breast cancer resources. And so one part of it, and it's part of a larger project called trashthepumpanddump.org, but I have a poster there that I made for the ER and the pharmacy that has a highlight of all of the anesthesia and, you know, common medications.
And so in my post-Austin enlightenment period, when I started thinking about this more and getting back to some of these resources that y'all had mentioned in preparation for this podcast, I also had a patient that we did an abdominal surgery on who was lactating. It was a great discussions between the anesthesia team and our surgery team. And in the end, the patient ultimately just said, well, I don't really want to worry about any of these things or the what ifs. I'm not taking any narcotics. And I am not breastfeeding for 24 hours after my operation. And what do you say to these patients? Is 24 hours of not breastfeeding such a terrible thing too? She was very happy with her decision and everyone's doing just great. So is that something you want to push?
I know we have both have a lot of thoughts. Yeah, I think everything with breastfeeding is really assessing patient goals. You want to make sure that they have the knowledge that you're providing them with in terms of medication safety and the ability to breastfeed. But also there are parents who do, I think, worry a lot, and really many parents want to keep their infant safe. So at the end of the day, it's really assessing their goals and their priorities and then talking about what's the plan then if we do have a 24-hour period where there's not breastfeeding, what might that look like? And so I think we're here to support patients and make sure that they're able to then get back on track if the goal is to then feed again.
And I just add that as a surgeon, counseling about lactation is the same as the way I would consent a patient for any surgical procedure, that I think it's important to lay out what Annie said at the outset, that I always say, I'm happy to do what makes you comfortable. However, I recommend XYZ for XYZ reason. I think also something to be aware of is that peripartum patients are very, very sensitive to, this is well documented in the perinatal mental health literature, actually, that they're very sensitive to emotions in the room around them, and they have this kind of heightened awareness. So if there's any sense that someone maybe didn't feel safe, that you were sort of saying the words, but you didn't really believe 100% what you were saying, that could cause a kernel of doubt in the patient's mind and say, no, hang on, wait, I don't want to breastfeed for 24 hours. So I think it is important to also advocate for continued uninterrupted breastfeeding because we know it's safe. And 24 hours of interruption of breastfeeding in an otherwise exclusively breastfed baby is a problem, unfortunately.
I absolutely agree with that. I think with breastfeeding as a whole, we do inflict, unfortunately, a lot of medical trauma with our uncertainty. And so there are many things that are uncertain with breastfeeding, but at least going in with the knowledge and being supportive can really go a long way with patients when they feel like you might not know, or you might feel that there could be an unsafe situation, they're going to try to do what's safest for their family. And so we want to make sure that we're giving accurate knowledge, that we're giving them options with appropriate risk assessment, and then allowing them to digest that information.
If the scenario changes and this is a patient now with biliary colic we're seeing in clinic and the plan is for elective cholecystectomy, are there things that we can set this patient up for success?
I guess I would say if something is elective, we would try to defer that until lactation is complete. I try to defer that like I would anything else elective. But I think otherwise, it's some of the same principles as what we've discussed with this acute situation. It's really nothing is particularly different other than you can potentially plan ahead for a larger surgery and know, for example, if you were having a surgery where someone would be intubated in the ICU post-op and that was planned for, that you would have a store of breast milk ahead of time. And that's when it's helpful to have a breastfeeding medicine physician involved in the care of the patient or a lactation consultant to help plan for the breast milk feeding of the baby.
Katrina, I heard you say that you want to avoid elective surgery until after lactation is complete. If we're with a patient who needs surgery in a slightly urgent manner, but not emergently, is there a certain couple months that we want to avoid? Like, are the first few months of lactation most important? There's no golden time rule.
I don't think there's a particular time rule. I think that, sure, if you don't have to do an operation on a mom early postpartum, that's ideal in general, just for her own recovery from birth, the physical, the hormonal impact of that change and separation from the baby. But it's the same as I'm always telling my colleagues in cancer care, that ultimately, in the end, you need to do what you need to do medically or surgically, and you shouldn't defer something that's otherwise indicated simply because of lactation. So, yeah, and I think also with what Annie had mentioned in terms of the plan, the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine has a great resource that involves a lot, all the comprehensive aspects of care of the hospitalized lactating dyad, breastfeeding dyad, so mom and baby, and plans for, say, pumping mom's breasts in an ICU when she's intubated, and obviously getting the breast milk to the baby prior to the intubation and sedation.
Katrina, when I was looking at your website, I came across the word oncolactation. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, it's a new one for me.
Sure. Thanks for bringing this up. This is a term that I created to describe the intersection of cancer care and lactation. And we have oncofertility, well defined, which involves counseling and supporting cancer patients in their fertility journey. And really, lactation should be just as much a part of this conversation about reproductive health as making a baby in the first place. So obviously, this comes up a lot with breast cancer surgery, but really all types of surgery and cancer care.
And there's some resources on your website as well. Like I said, we'll put that in the show notes. So let's finish this off with some quick hits or some take-home points. Annie, do you want to share some pearls of wisdom as we exit?
Sure. I think pearls of wisdom, breastfeeding patients, we all interact with them. So it's really important to know about their care in terms of surgery. And then know your hospital policies, or if your hospital doesn't have a policy related to caring for lactating parents, then get somebody to get one happening, get a team together, because this is really important.
And Katrina?
Thanks. And I think the sort of big picture take-home point for me would be that pumping and dumping is rarely indicated. And it's going to be much more the exception than the rule if you do have an uncommon situation where you'd have to pump and dump.
That's fantastic. Austin, do you want to take it home?
I'm so excited. Dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org for more great content. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please take a minute to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening.
Until next time, dominate the day.